Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And today we go back to 1957 and the 1950s. 50 years ago? How could it be 50 years ago?
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. Well, you know you love me, baby. Still, you tell me maybe that someday will
U.S. News and World Report has an interesting cover story this week. A year that changed America. Can we go so far as to say 1957 did that? The article says that every decade contends a single year that epitomizes its era. In the 1950s, Americans had never been happier. They had steady paychecks, intact families, and more often, two cars in the garage. And yet looming over all was the threat of the global nuclear war. The Soviets' launch of Sputnik caught the country off guard, setting off the space race. Growing racial tensions reaching a peak in Little Rock, stirrings of a different kind of rebellion accompanying the limited introduction of the birth control pill. Jack Kerouac creating sensation with On the Road. The Etzel was born, and then it died shortly thereafter. Former admin Dr. Seuss revolutionized the way kids learn to read. Half a century later, it's a year that, for better or worse, the article says, planted the roots for a new America. Do you agree with that? Do our guests agree with that? We're happy to have two guests with us on the air for this examination of the 1950s and 1957 in particular. And you can join our conversation, as always. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. Joining us is Professor Glenn Atschuler, is the Thomas and Dorothy Litwin Professor of American Studies and the Dean of the School of Continuing Education and Summer Sessions at Cornell University. He has written extensively. He wrote a column, actually, on higher education for a number of years for the New York Times. He's a regular panelist on national and international affairs for the WCNY television program and has won many awards for teaching and undergraduate advising at Cornell. And we thank him very much for being with us. Professor Atschuler, thank you.
There.
Yeah, great to have you here. Also joining us is Professor Larry May, and Professor Larry May teaches in the American Studies Department at the University of Minnesota. He's been doing research and writing, focusing on the intersection between American popular culture, particularly the film industry, and politics. He's looked at the rise of a modern consumer culture, which is a part of what happened in the 50s, and its relation to public struggles over race, class, and gender. Author of a number of books, including The Big Tomorrow, Hollywood, and the Politics of American Identity. And he is also author of Screening Out the Past, The Birth of Mass Culture, and the Motion Picture Industry. Professor May, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, glad to join you.
All right, let's look at 1957. I thought that it was interesting that this article said that this was a year of great contentment on the part of Americans. We were happy. We had steady money. We had two cars. Life was good. Did most of us perceive that year as being good, do you think?
Well, many of us perceived it, and if we were white, and if we were in the middle class, we certainly perceived it all the more, because this was an era in which some of those who were not participating in the prosperity of America were less visible. They were less visible on television. They were less visible in films. They were less visible in bestsellers. So to the extent that you saw images on the big screen or the small screen, you were more likely to see people who were quite quite content with that.
Yeah, and we were beginning to see people who were not content. This, of course, was the year of Eisenhower ordering troops into Little Rock. All of a sudden, this underlying issue, this big issue of race, which is still a big issue, was on our television sets.
Yeah, absolutely. And race, of course, was always a significant issue for Americans, but it became so much more visible after Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, and then with African Americans asserting their rights as American citizens and forcing a very reluctant Dwight Eisenhower to intervene.
Mm-hmm. Professor May, you want to give...
Well, I think I would start with that I don't fully agree with that, and I want to start by saying that the 1950s is a hot issue amongst cultural historians as it is in the political arena. If you are of the conservative bent, as such as ex-majority leader of the House, Newt Gingrich, the 1950s is the pinnacle of American power, prosperity, and virtue. A whole generation of recent scholars, they tend to be of the generation that I'm part of, tend to now be in their 50s, the baby boomers, tend to see the 1950s as not simply where African Americans were discontent, but that you have to see it as the roots of the 1960s, when both the youth, you know, if everything was so wonderful in the 1950s in the white middle class and contented, why did you get an enormous youth rebellion that, granted, was driven by a minority, but nonetheless began to spread and touch all elements of the culture? And rock and roll, which is the sort of foreshadowing of it, which you started with the Buddy Holly, That'll Be the Day, is also exploding in the 1950s and grabbing a whole generation of youth. And the most, one of the most popular filmmakers of the 1950s is Alfred Hitchcock. And in his films, you are seeing, in a popular suspense form, nonetheless, a deep unease amongst white males, and particularly women in North by Northwest, and in things like Psycho. And it is not, I think what you do have is what a lot of historians, or if there's containment in foreign policy, there is also a containment at home, where many elements of what is going to come to the surface in the 1960s and our culture wars ever since, that there's a big lid has been put on it in the 1950s, and it's not spoken about because of the Cold War itself has made political criticism of American life suspect, and it is also the prosperity has been kind of the carrot that you be silent and you can get these this affluence, and that is you know, one of the dynamics of the 50s. And let me say also that U.S. News and World Report, I worked for them as an undergraduate.
Oh, really?
And they are a very conservative. They are much more, you know, conservatives look back to the 1950s from Ronald Reagan on as the great era. The other side of our cultural wars looks on the 1950s as a period of a great period of containment that set the roots for the 1960s and beyond, that it isn't just this sudden, you know, greatness, and we felt
it. Right. Let's talk a little bit about the Cold War. It seems to me as though a shadow really hung over that decade, and particularly the latter part of the decade. There were fallout drills. School children all over the country were going under their desks. I was pretty young in those years, but I remember having dreams about World War III virtually every other night.
Well, you know, the nuclear era, which, of course, begins at the end of World War II, is something that that many figures and in the 1950s are responding to. It's beneath and behind some of the anxieties that are either sensed or expressed in the 1950s, and that's part and parcel of the culture. The more that there were attempts to reassure Americans that fallout wasn't dangerous, that that we were the superior force, and so on, the more those anxieties were stoked.
And it was from the benefit of history, as we look at all that was taking place during that time, this buildup of nuclear weapons, the fear that the Soviets had much more than we did, were we kind of sold a bill of goods here?
In what respect?
In terms of they didn't have what we thought they had, or we were told what they had wasn't really what they had.
Well, you know, one of the concerns I think we always have, and it's certainly true now with all of this talk of terrorism, is how great is the danger, and how much is that danger being emphasized in a way that allows the powerful to assume even greater power over all of us. In the Cold War, we had assertions, as you know, about missile gaps and imminent dangers and domino theories that turned out not to be true. How knowing the powers that be were about these things is something that people disagree about.
Talk about the role of women for a moment, the influence, the thoughts of people like Betty Friedan. The magazine does have some interesting pictures of women who are at an Ivy League school all dressed in their kind of long skirts and hats and the sweaters, and it really typifies the era. There was a stirring during the latter part of the 1950s that I think had profound ramifications for everybody, for American society.
The Betty Friedan and the coming of the women's
movement. Yeah, the changing in the role of women.
Yeah, I think that it's one of the big stories of the 1950s. You had a very powerful images, and Friedan writes about this, and I think she's right, of women in the public arena in the 1930s films, and it carried off into World War II. Women surged into the workforce and male occupations in the war.
Yeah.
And then there was a sudden turnaround. Riveter was both, I think, on many levels volunteer, but also.
I'm sorry, your phone is kind of cutting out. Go ahead.
Let me pitch in here and say that when Betty Friedan talked about comfortable concentration camps and a problem that had no name, those phrases resonated with many women who were coming of age, who had young families in the 1950s. And it's also the case that, as Larry May was suggesting, that many women in the 1950s had worked during World War II.
Right,
and this is often not known. Many women were still working. In the 1950s, a significant percentage of them working. So again, you have this sort of public image that every adult woman is at home in the suburbs with a couple of kids, reasonably affluent, looking like Leave It to Beaver, when in fact that was not the case. And even some of the June Cleavers were not as happy as maybe June appeared to be on that show.
There was a whole, when you mentioned the word suburbs, this whole image came to my mind of all that was built in the country during those years as well, 1950s. We built the suburbs, right? We built this, and I'm wondering where that design came from and where, to have this ideal, this American ideal of two cars in the garage and, you know, a pretty good school system and a ranch house in the suburbs, all of that, and a lot of that still exists today, but that's when it started, right?
One of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that the federal interstate highway designed by President Eisenhower, based on defense, really is one element that makes that kind of suburbanization possible. So the Cold War and what Professor May is calling domestic containment are very much intertwined in almost every respect.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if your phone is better here. You want to weigh in on this, Professor May?
Well, I've been getting a lot of static. I don't know why.
I don't either.
But we'll start over.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, just to tie in what we were previously speaking about, the nuclear fear fed into the building of the interstate highway system, which in turn helped people move out to the suburbs at government expense. You know, they got it subsidized.
Mm-hmm.
And it is to disperse the population in case of nuclear attack.
Hmm.
The suburbs are also heavily financed by subsidies to the middle class through GI bills, which tend to favor far more men than women. I mean, they become the ones who take out the mortgages. So the capacity to do all this is part of a war culture that has been created from World War II into the Cold War. Now, what spurs the desire of millions of people to start doing it is a one that, you know, historians are still knocking around. One of them is the argument about, well, female containment. One that I think of as very, you know, as I look back on the period, is that what happens in the post-war period that was never there in the American political arena prior to this time is the legitimation of the corporations.
Hmm.
Prior to that time, we had from Theodore Roosevelt through Franklin Roosevelt an attack on the corporations as malefactors of wealth, as money changers in the temple. And this resonated with a great many people, not just because of the economic crises, but also because of what was happening to work, that work is becoming far more regimented and regularized than in the past. You don't control your own property. So the way I see one of the impulses of the 1950s is the suburbs are the desire for many people, men and women, to find a new realm of freedom outside work. And it surrounds the home. The home becomes not simply a place where you raise children, but a place where you have recreation, golf courses, swimming pools. This whole ideal, which used to be in the 20s, confined to movie stars and the rich, is democratized in the 1950s. And people can say, okay, 9 to 5, but it's going to pay well. And it's going to be, I'm going to be in the office, it's going to be more regimented, but I can find that freedom outside in my home life. And to top it off, just think of the names. I mean, like where I live in Minneapolis, the suburbs are called Golden Valley, Eden Prairie. You're going back to a 19th century world of,
right,
of a kind of freedom and where you can have fulfillment. But it isn't any longer focused on work, which the home had a whole panoply of things surrounding it, from the farm to small businessmen prior to that time.
Interesting. Well, was it indeed a source of great pleasure then? For a lot of Americans, we're talking about the angst that many people felt, but was it a source of, you know, great pleasure? The evening cocktail, the meal, you left the work behind, you went for a swim in the pool. Life was okay for some people.
Well, as always, these things are mixed blessings. And, you know, in the suburbs, you didn't have as many multi-generational families as you might have had in earlier eras.
Mm.
People were spreading out a little bit more. There was a lot of keeping up with the Joneses and a lot of pressure in keeping up with the Joneses. Is your car in the driveway going to be as up to date as the one in the next driveway? The pleasures in social life was different for a lot of people. On the other hand, for many families, there was a lot more room. Children would have their own room. The parents had a different set of social connections, and so a different lifestyle really evolved around the suburbs.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls. I think we're going to have some interesting ones this hour. We're talking about the 1950s, our conversation prompted by U.S. News and World Report having a cover story on 1957, which they have defined as the year in the decade of the 1950s that epitomized its era. What do you think? We have two guests with us, Professor Glenn Altshuler, Thomas and Dorothy Litwin, Professor of American Studies and Dean of Continuing Education and Summer Session at Cornell University, Professor Larry May, Professor of American Studies at the University of Minnesota. Both gentlemen have written extensively about this era in American history. Okay, to your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up. My hands are shaky and my knees are weak. I can't seem to stand on my own two feet. Who do you think of when you have such luck? I'm in love. I'm all shook up.
We're talking about the 1950s, and particularly 1957, this hour of the program. Our guests, Professor Larry May, Professor of American Studies at the University of Minnesota, and Professor Glenn Altshuler, who is Dean of Continuing Education in the Summer Session and a Professor of American Studies at Cornell University. And we are going to start taking your phone calls. Rick is first from Appleton. Hi, Rick.
Oh, hi. I'm raring to go. I've got an elderly friend. He's 76 years old. He regales me with stories about what it was like in the 50s. Now, what he constantly tells me is that in the 1950s, the American white man, he's a white man, was the king of the world. He's telling me that the American white man was the king of the world. And if I can just briefly explain why, he grew up in one of these hardscrabble farms in the northern Wisconsin woods. His parents were financially very, very poor, being farmers. Father had to participate in bootlegging off and on to supplement the family income. He went into the Marine Corps at 17, so he didn't finish high school. He was slightly wounded in Korea. Then after that, he got a job with the United States Treasury Service, kind of like a grease monkey working on the presses that print currency. That job was going okay, but it had its ups and downs. There was a Wisconsin congressman, I think his name was Ken Ziorski. He came and visited the Treasury. He says, is there anybody from Wisconsin working in this department? And they search their records and say, oh, yeah, only one guy, this friend of mine. The next morning he comes to work, he was automatically promoted to foreman of his whole division there and with the printing presses. Mm-hmm. Then the federal government sent him on these trips all over the world, free of charge, of the best airliners you could find. And they educated him for free. They paid for all his hotel bills. He spent months in Latin America, Asia, Europe, all this kind of stuff. When he retired, his pension check from the federal government is $65,000 a year.
Well, we got to hold you there because we got a lot of other calls coming in.
I think it's important to... There's no question that there was a racial hierarchy in the United States in the 1950s, but it's also worth pointing out that when Michael Harrington in 1962 writes the book The Other America, and he's talking about poverty, he's also pointing out that many, many millions of whites were living in impoverished conditions throughout the United States, but they weren't all that visible in the 1950s.
Yeah, we started paying attention to those issues more in the 1960s, right?
More in the 60s, but that doesn't mean it wasn't there in the 1950s.
Right. Let's go back to this, the beginnings of the discontent and all the movements we saw in the 1960s. What was it that was creating this angst? Was it a life of boredom? Was it, a life of privilege being meaningless? Or what stirred us to be unhappy?
Well, let me say a couple of things, and I think I can make the tie-in from what we just heard. When you do get to the 1960s, where you find the anger about the explosion of discontent and talking about culture is from the same working or people who work with their hands that have made done very well from World War II through the 1950s, and are the working class and the white working class, particularly in the North. They are deeply offended by what starts to unfold in the 1960s, and they provide a sort of backbone of what will allow Nixon to win and what we call the conservative backlash. Now, the discontent comes from minorities, and it comes also from tens, you know, in a disproportionate way, to come from university campuses, which tend to be the children of this white middle class of the suburbs that we've been talking about. And, you know, there it gets complicated, but there's what they resonate to is a feeling that something is deeply wrong and they don't feel good about their lives. You can see it in the music, you can see it in the popular culture, you can see it in the foreign films, particularly Antonioni and Bergman, who just died,
mm-hmm.
that these students are watching avidly from the late 50s. I mean, this is where the big audience comes from the northern cities, and it also comes from college campuses. And this kind of discontent of this, what I would call this new middle class, white-collar workers, they feel this anxiety about, and the suburbs, about whether they want to go be like their parents and grow up into that same world. And then when you get the war and you get the black rebellion, they all hit together.
Mm-hmm.
If I might just elaborate on that, many of our people see great discontinuity between the 1950s and the 1960s.
Yeah.
It's more important to see the continuities, it seems to me. And a lot of what Professor May was talking about involves social and cultural discontents that are building in the 1950s among the constituencies that he's talked about, including young people expressed through rock and roll and in other cultural forms on film. In the 1960s, those cultural and social discontents deepen, and they also take on a political form and an anti-establishment a form in more visible kinds of ways.
And never underestimate the Cold War. I mean, the fact that Vietnam hits in the middle of all of this just creates the kind of turmoil and fervor of the 1960s that carries over into the 1970s, and a lot of the creativity and a lot of the problems that we've inherited from it.
And one way also to think about it is that Elvis, in a way, in the 50s, simultaneously appealed to the rebellious side of people, young people, and the conformist side of people at one and the same time. And that's I think that's the uniqueness and distinctiveness of his appeal.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1960s, the appeal takes a somewhat different form.
What about now? Does he appeal to both sides now, too?
Let me just jump on that, and
yeah.
I will answer that one, too. It's embodied in Elvis's life. I mean, I think it's not insignificant that he goes into the army. He is seen as the rebellious teenager who will eventually grow up and conform to the predicted roles of the larger society. And there is where he, you know, you can see the conformity and the rebellion coming right together. And think about what happens in the 1960s. You couldn't imagine John Lennon, for example, going into the army either in Britain or here.
No.
The Beatles or Bob Dylan. I mean, it's a completely,
right.
You know, it's a different emphasis has begun to occur in a very powerful way. Now, how is he seen now? You know, there was an editorial in the New York Times about a week or two ago about trying to defend Elvis from a lot of hip-hop artists who claim that Elvis was really racist. And this person, I think correctly, said, no, you go back to the 1950s, and he has an intersection with blacks. He's singing black music. He's breaking barriers. I think that's all true. But what that article did not mention is what happens then when he goes to Hollywood. He doesn't have any blacks in those movies that he makes. And there's a famous story that's in Sammy Davis Jr. autobiography that Davis and Elvis were first cast to play in The Defiant Ones, which is a film by Kramer that comes out in the mid-50s or so, where a white and a black are chained together. And Colonel Parker says, no, this will destroy your audience if you play a film with an African-American.
Oh, my.
So I do think that what did happen to Elvis is that those first, let's say, 6, 7, 8 years, there is this breaking of racial barriers. But he, in a lot of ways, although the music still has a strong African root, African-American roots to it, he is going much more assimilation into this kind of white culture. And he ends up, I mean, I've been to Graceland now twice. I'm really struck by how the audience is just people like me. They're all white. And the people going on the tour, and all of the, not all, much of the people who are doing the service work are African-American.
Right, interesting. Do you want to comment on that, Professor Altshuler?
I think, you know, in a sense, one of the things that's happened is that we have more and more domesticated and commodified rebelliousness.
Yeah.
So that rebelliousness now is seen as something, okay, I'm rebellious too. And one can accept that rebelliousness without actually being, and even celebrate it, without it actually translating into the kind of rebelliousness that makes for change.
Mm.
And so I think Elvis's ongoing popularity includes the ability to do that, just as in the 1950s, even though Elvis frequently talked about his indebtedness to blacks, many of his audiences in the South were wearing Confederate caps.
Right. Oh, my. And what, so what about the rebelliousness? Talk more. That intrigues me. Is it what, that we're wearing tattoos, we get piercings all over the place, or what? What's our rebelliousness now?
Well, we have a celebrity culture now that is soaked in pseudo-rebelliousness.
Hmm.
And that pseudo-rebelliousness is something that we consume as consumers, just like we consume any other form of entertainment.
Hmm. Let's go back to phone calls. Daniel from Rice Lake is next. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. In the 50s, above-ground testing of nuclear weapons spread nuclear fallout across the nation and world. As children, we were fed iodine pills. I can remember the taste, so that our goiters would be, so we called them goiter pills, so that our thyroids would not absorb radioactive iodine. Wasn't nuclear testing above ground an horrendous historical crime, unbelievable today?
Who wants to take it?
Are we supposed to answer that? I mean, yeah. I mean, I think the nuclear testing was not a good thing, you know, and I'm glad eventually they got around to at least there were political pressures to ban it. And, you know, in the 1950s, it was, you had Bikini Atoll, at least in the late 40s, and, you know, then there was an abeyance of it. But there was, you know, underground testing, and, you know, the science of that surely must be that some of that stuff did escape, you know, and it's a great danger.
Yeah, and I think the most disturbing thing about the testing is that there appears to have been far more knowledge about the negative consequences of fallout than the public was made aware of in the 1950s, and that's really the shame.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 1950s, that damage was done when people knew and should have known that damage was occurring.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great acceptance in the 50s of one way to characterize it, that there were tons of secrets rolling around the society, whether they were in people's personal life. Yes, I was on the left in the 1930s, but I'm not going to talk about that. Or yes, I worked, but now I'm a housewife and I miss it, but I'm not going to talk about that. There was a lot of silent discontent that people did not voice, because it would be unpatriotic. You know, the United States was sold in the world as the superior culture and the most powerful country, and to question that, you know, people saw the consequences of that. There was blacklisting in the society, and there were people being excluded. Like, for example, the testimony that we earlier had about you know, this person got up and said something positive about the company and the nation in this before the government official, he's rewarded. There were just as many people when they would say something negative who would be not rewarded,
right,
and would be banned. And I'm sitting here right in front of me. There's a great film made in 1954 that was absolutely blacklisted, Salt of the Earth, and it just didn't get any release. And when the blacklist ended, the writer goes on to help write Bridge on the River Kwai, wins the Academy Award. So, you know, there is this kind of going underground in 1950 and not saying things that will be said by the 1960s.
There was also, at the same time, if polls are any evidence at all, a much greater trust in government, officials, and government institutions than there is today. And today, many of the comments about fallout, for example, would be greeted with considerably more skepticism,
yes,
and challenged much more than they were then. The challenges were not occurring, in part because of fear, as I think Professor May is implying, in part because of trust.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the fear and the trust. I mean, the leaders, who's your president? Dwight Eisenhower. He is the credited with one of the masterminds of winning World War II. And there's this, you know, yes, they've won. There was a faltering in Korea, but now we're back and we're winning again. So there is this trust in authority. And there's a very telling example of the ambivalence that's embedded in this. Is there's a book written by my colleague Elaine May called Homeward Bound, and it is thousands of interviews she draws on with women in the 1950s in middle-class environments.
Oh.
And they fill out forms, and in the forms, the official forms, how is your marriage? Oh, it's terrific. We have affluence and blah, blah, blah. And then at the bottom, where they say, do you have anything more to say, and you can have free flowing.
Right.
They had faith in their husbands, faith in the country in the official form, and in the other part of the form began to say, I'm really unhappy. This marriage is really working like, I think one of the lines she's got quoted is, we work like a well-oiled machine.
Oh my.
But basically at its basis, I don't feel right. But the point is, there is that faith in authority. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But there is this kind of rumbling beneath that you can pick up in various areas. For me, it's the popular culture or elements like that.
Yeah. Professor Altshuler, I don't know if you have a class to go. You need to leave us.
Yes, I do.
All right. I thank you so much for being with us. This has really been an interesting hour. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I enjoyed sharing the podium, so to speak, with Professor May, whose work is just simply wonderful.
All right. Thanks. You very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Professor May is staying with us, so your calls can be directed to him. 800-486-8655. We thank Professor Glenn Altshuler, who is Dean of Continuing Education and Summer Session at Cornell University and a Professor of American Studies. Professor Larry May remains with us, Professor of American Studies at the University of Minnesota. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Professor May's research and writing focusing on the intersection between American popular culture, particularly the film industry, and politics. He's written about the rise of a modern consumer culture and its relation to public struggles over race, class, and gender in the U.S. from the turn of the century to 1960. He has won all kinds of awards for his teaching, and he is the author of The Big Tomorrow, Hollywood and the Politics of American Identity, and also Screening Out the Past, The Birth of Mass Culture and the Motion Picture Industry. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Charlie Parker looked like Buddha. Charlie Parker, who recently died laughing at a juggler on TV after weeks of strain and sickness, was called the perfect musician. And his expression on his face was as calm, beautiful, and profound as the image of the Buddha represented in the East. The lidded eyes, the expression that says, all is well. This was what Charlie Parker said when he played, "All is well." He had the feeling of early in the morning, like a hermit's joy, or like the perfect cry of some wild gang at a jam session, "Wail, whop." Charlie burst his lungs to reach the speed of what the speedsters wanted, and what they wanted was his eternal slowdown.
Jack Kerouac on Charlie Parker. We're talking about the 1950s, 800-486-8655. Let's spend a few moments talking about Kerouac and maybe some of the other beat poets who emerged at that time. You know, what a contrast with this idyllic suburban life that we were talking about some of this hour to hear Kerouac's poetry.
That was a great record that you had there, I must admit.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah,
and I think what's very significant about the beats is, you know, this starts in the 40s and it goes through the 50s. They are the first popular movement you can find intellectuals in American culture before that, but who popularized Eastern philosophy within the United States. You notice he said that Parker was like the Buddha head and it was sun. And no, they become very much into Japanese Buddhism, and they popularize it as a sort of alternative to this mainstream culture, and they create communities in, well, they, several places, but the most obvious is in San Francisco and then Greenwich Village in New York. And they're constantly written about and featured in Time and Life magazines, so there's a kind of fascination with them in the mainstream culture as well.
Right. Let's go to Ruth from Ladysmith next. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, I'm afraid there's a big disconnect between the beats and what I was going to talk about.
That's all right. It's all part of the same thing.
I was 9 and 10 years old in 1957, and that was a really big and bad year for me because my mother became mentally ill, and then I had to go live with some with a foster family. But the interesting part was that I lived on Staten Island at first, and I used to go to a public pool sometimes, and there were black people and all kinds of people, Hispanics and whites, and I didn't think anything of it, and nobody said anything. And then when I went to live in a children's home up out, well, everybody calls it upstate, but it was only actually about 30 miles away, there were many Hispanic kids in the home, and there were some black kids and white kids. I guess there were mostly Hispanic kids, and still nobody said anything. There wasn't. I didn't feel that there was any discrimination among the kids, racially or anything. Of course, I was only 9 years old, so I wasn't really clued into anything. And then a family took me to live with them as foster child, with my sisters, right near there, and it was up, you know, out in the countryside where they had just put in the new development. And the father, my foster father, was a bus driver in New York City, so he had a long commute. He had like 30, 35, maybe 40 miles each way into the city to drive a bus every day. But he wanted his kids out of there, and I remember comments that they made about black people moving into their area. They lived in, what's the part of New York that's around Fordham Avenue and up there? Not Harlem, but the Bronx.
The Bronx.
Okay. Yeah, they lived in the Bronx, and I guess as soon as the black people started to move in that area, the white people just out to the suburbs to these developments. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was one of the big things is the northern migration of blacks and this fear. I guess it was fear because I heard some pretty nasty comments, and I hadn't never thought about it as a kid, and there weren't any black people at all in my area. When I got into high school, well, there was one black family that came to my elementary school. Then when I moved to high school, which was right nearby, Nyack, New York, you might know it. It's right across the Tappan Zee Bridge from White Plains area. There were quite a few black people in that town. But at that time, I think that maybe racism was the main reason why people were moving out there. And you know, I didn't really feel it personally, but I heard it a lot.
Yeah, you had a few things probably as a 9-year-old you could have taught people who were much older than you.
Well, just go back to a couple of our earlier things, that those mortgages that are given, you know, to returning GI vets are financed through banks, private enterprise rather than the government. And they're backed by the government, but they're given through the banks. Mm-hmm. And the banks are following real estate real estate brokers' guidelines, which is to redline districts to not have blacks. So the suburbs are 98% white. I mean, you know, one of the elements about moving to the suburbs is kind of in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, and a little bit of a change now. The suburbs were lily white, and they are the place where you kind of preserve this kind of white America. And I think that this story is very true. The cities are far more pluralistic, and they have been, and they remain that way. But when you start, the suburbs are all about this movement out and kind of a whitening of yourself. And it also has to do usually, not usually, but a great percentage in the northern cities has to do with people of white immigrant descent becoming fully American by moving to the suburbs and being white.
Thanks so much for the call. Nathaniel is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I think actually the my call might dovetail with hers to some extent, where you talked about suburbanization getting going in the 50s, and one of the things that I was talking about or was going to is L.A., and that now maybe it'll turn out to be bogus, but I heard that there was a study done recently in L.A. that found that people of differing ethnic groups were becoming very untrusting of each other. And something else that I independently heard about L.A., now granted is a town, it existed for years before then, but it had a huge growth spurt, like at a lot of places in the 50s. I heard someone sort of criticizing it for a place where there's a lot of social isolation.
Well, okay. Are we back?
We sure are.
Okay. That's one of the, you know, endless complaints about the suburbs in terms of social isolation. I don't know the study that he's referring to, but half of my life, I consider myself, you know, three homes. New York City, because I grew up there. L.A., because I grew up half the time there. Huh. And then now, because I've been in Minneapolis for 30 years. So I, you know, go back and forth because I have relatives in them. The thing that strikes me about L.A. is true, there is a kind of middle-class flight now into the suburbs. But what I'm struck by is it's very, the suburbs now tend to be down towards San Diego or the other way up the coast. They tend to be very pluralistic now. And I don't know what this references were to tensions besides, you know, we live in America. Those tensions are there. The question is how we resolve them. And at least the areas that I've been in, they tend to be not any type of people trying to, I won't talk to him or her because of a certain race. But that breaking of the all-white lily suburbs is starting to happen in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But in the period we're talking about, it was definitely all-white.
It sure was. Thanks so much for the call. Lee is next from Franklin. Hi, Lee.
Oh, hi. In 1957, were America's Middle East policies more balanced between Israeli and Arab interests, thus making America safer from foreign resentment? I mean, ever since Eisenhower, America has been seen as having a policy that Israel is almost always much preferred.
Okay. I don't know if you want to respond to that or not, Professor May.
Well, just to say that Israel has been recently by Truman, you know, we backed it and we helped create it. I suppose you could say there were a lot of tensions, but in those period, America was seen as the agent of trying to decolonize the Mideast and a new force that helped create peace between in the Mideast. And you can see this in the Suez Crisis where Eisenhower intervened and forced the Israelis and the French and the English to withdraw and sort of acted as an arbitrator. But the point is that it hasn't been, we've been involved in the Mideast from the 50s because of oil and Israel, and it hadn't reached the kind of explosive potential that we now see in the last 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. And we have another caller. We're running short on time. Hi, your name is?
Hi, Janice from La Crosse.
Hi,
I
Janice.
I just want to say hi. I just love this topic. But I was born in 48, so I'm a real baby boomer. But, of course, lived in a small little town in the Midwest here, obviously, La Crosse. Never locked a door. You know, absolutely had a great time. I mean, by that I mean the no fear. At least I felt I grew up without any fear until the '60s, until Kennedy got assassinated, and everybody. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, what happened? You know, what is this? You know, so that scared the life out of us. And then, of course, now I'm all pro-life, but we let everything rip after that, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, too much. You know, everything went way over the top, and now we're trying to come back to semblance of values and morals that we just, to me, I'm the generation that let that whole thing break down. But, boy, the '60s did it. And the '50s was fun. I loved it.
Professor May.
Well, this is the We Got It classic. I said there's a real division in this country about what the '50s meant, and it relates to one's current politics. I don't share the current caller's politics now, and I think that when I look at the 1950s, I'm much more with those who say this was really a stifling period, and what you look at is this great contentment had a lot of discontent within it, and what happened in the 1950s. Is there's continuity between the two. But the dating that she pointed out is right. People really feel it. The assassinations cannot be underestimated as making people feel that we've lost our bearings.
Boy, did we ever feel that way. You were a terrific guest. Join us again. We got so much more to talk about, but we're plumb out of time. Thank you. Thank you, Professor May. Professor Larry May, Professor of American Studies at the University of Minnesota. Thanks so much to Rhonda Fanning for producing this really interesting hour, John Treader for on-air production, and to you for listening and calling. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.